This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to the 2013 BBC Reith Lectures Download. This year I, Grayson Perry, present a series of four lectures entitled Playing to the Gallery. In these lectures I'll be looking at the role and place of art in the global landscape of the 21st century, talking about topics such as the role of art in society, the limits of contemporary art, and the idea of how we judge quality.
Hello and welcome to Tate Modern in London for the first of this year's BBC Reith Lectures. They're called Playing to the Gallery, an appropriately ironic title for a lecturer who says of his work, it sneaks up on people and seduces them, and I like that. After studying fine art at Portsmouth Polytechnic, he started taking pottery lessons and was soon exhibiting his work. That was back in 1983. 20 years later, he won the Turner Prize, and the potter who up till then had been talked of as an artist's artist became an important force in the world of art. His highly decorated vases and plates are classically beautiful, but they carry a subversive message, spiky, he calls it. He's made his name in ceramics, but he works in other media too. His series of tapestries charting a modern rake's progress from working-class childhood to death in a Ferrari was a centrepiece of this year's Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. He sees himself as a modern Hogarth or Gilray, an acute but irreverent observer of the social scene, who can use his talents not only to mock, but also to enliven and explain the way we live now. He's also a well-known cross-dresser. As he said when he won that big prize, it's about time a transvestite potter won the Turner. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Grayson Perry. You have fans. I have to say, Grayson, that this must be the first time in the 65-year history of Reith that a cross-dresser has been the lecturer.
Well, as far as we know.
Touché.
Not for the eyebrows, I always say.
Touché. Listen, this is radio. You have to describe what you're wearing.
Yes, I'm usually dressed by St. Martin's students now. So this sort of oversized T-shirt in psychedelic colours was made by a student called Angus, a Chinese student, actually. And I'm wearing my orange patent flat forms, I think.
Well, we should describe them. I mean, they're huge. They're pale orange patent. Why are they flat forms? They've got
because heels. They're quite flat. They're quite comfy, but they've got a four-inch platform.
They are comfy.
Yeah.
They are huge. And dark turquoise tights, sea green tights, you prefer to call them, with matching eyeshadow.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between subtle and... Some people think that subtle is dull, they get it muddled up. But I think you can be subtle with bright colours.
And you're looking subtle today.
Yeah.
Now, I gather that it was originally Radio 4 in the form of the Archers, which is not known as a kind of hotbed of the avant-garde, that actually gave you the idea that contemporary art had now become mainstream. Is that right?
Yeah, I think for me the watershed moment was when Linda Snell, the kind of self-appointed cultural ambassador to Ambridge, if you like, she tried to get someone from Ambridge onto the fourth plinth when Anthony Gormley was doing the one and the other project. And so I thought, if Linda Snell is a kind of fan of contemporary art, then the game is won or lost, depending on where you look at it. You know, it's no longer a kind of little backwater cult. It is now a part of mainstream cultural life.
And you're going to deliver four lectures on it. Just in a nutshell, what do you hope to achieve with these lectures?
Well, I hope to ask and try to answer those obvious questions. I think that a lot of people who aren't, you know, members of the art world ask when they go into a gallery and they're slightly bemused or maybe angered by the work. And I want to sort of maybe say, you know, help them, give them tools to understand and appreciate art.
Grayson Perry, your podium awaits.
Thank you. Right. Now, the first question I'd like to answer is, why had the BBC asked me, Grayson Perry artist, to give the Reef lectures this year? And I think it's because I am a practicing artist. I am the person who is confronted with a blank sheet of paper or a lump of clay, and I have to literally make the sort of decision of what am I going to do on a day-to-day basis. And I'm not just a commentator on the art world. I am one of the foot soldiers, if you like. And I work on the coal face of culture. But nowadays, of course, we live in an era when it's mainly a service economy. So perhaps really it should be the call centre of culture that we work on nowadays. And also, as a practitioner, and not necessarily an expert in the wider sense, I can use what is often seen as a sin by many academics, that is autobiography as analysis. I can extrapolate from my own personal experience kind of a wider generalisations about the art world, and that's exactly what I'm going to do a lot of the time. And I've called this series of lectures Playing to the Gallery, and not, you may note, sucking up to an academic elite. Because I want to talk about my business, the art world. And when I mean the art world is, you know, the stuff you see in museums, like here in Tate Modern, and in commercial galleries all around London and the world, and also in biennales, fairs. You might see it on a roundabout. And nowadays, pretty much anywhere you might see contemporary art, in the street, or even in cyberspace. But I think, you know, that's the business that I want to talk about, visual art, really. Though, of course, you know, as we will find later on, it's not all visual. Because historically, I think, the art world has been fairly inward-looking, because it can operate as a fairly closed circle in many ways. There's many artists who are very successful who don't need the public at all. There's a closed circle of the artist, the dealer, the collector. You don't necessarily need a wider audience. But there's one message that I want these sort of lectures to carry. It is that anybody can enjoy art and anybody can have a life in the arts. Even me, an Essex transvestite potter, the mafia has even let me in. And it's a nice life. Come in. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's not like being a celebrity. But it's a very rewarding and exciting place, you know, to hang out. I mean, here we are in Tate Modern now. It's the first or second most popular tourist destination in the country. 5.3 million visitors a year. And I suppose in some ways I'm talking to those people, but not all of them. So I looked at some Arts Council survey on audience segmentation. Who are the people that I'm talking to with this lecture? And they divided up the audience for art museums and galleries into several categories. And I don't really need to talk to what are called the urban arts eclectic or the mature explorer, because they're a guaranteed shoe-in. They'd come anyway. And I haven't got a chance with the bedroom DJs or the time-poor dreamers. I'm working on the 36% who are dinner and a show or fun, fashion and friends. So that's who I'm working on. They're the people I'm talking to. Now, art is very popular, but I think many people are still quite insecure around galleries, going into galleries, particularly commercial galleries, quite intimidating. They're very good-looking gallery girls on the front and all that sort of thing. And the language. And so I'm hoping, you know, I want to answer a few of the very basic questions that perhaps, you know, people even in the art world think that it's almost too gauche to ask. They might think they're irrelevant, or even they've all been answered now and everybody knows the answer. So I'm starting with this lecture, and it is called Democracy Has Bad Taste. Because I want to talk about an issue of quality, because I think this is one of the most burning issues around art. How do we tell if something is good? And who tells us that it's good? That's perhaps even more important. And of course, now in the art world as it is, does it really matter? And I want to talk about what are the criteria by which we judge art made today. Now, there's no easy answer for this one, I'm sorry to say. I'm not going to live up to sort of like the Reef lecturer's code of honour, which is to have definite, strong opinions and be a kind of certainty freak. Because many of the methods of judging art, of course, are very problematic. And many of the criteria that you use to assess art are conflicting. I mean, we have financial value, popularity, art historical significance, or aesthetic sophistication. You know, all these things could be at odds with each other. If I go back, really, when I started thinking about the idea of quality, in my second year at art college, it was almost de rigueur at that point that you had to dabble in performance art. This is 30 years ago. It was a thing you had to do, a little bit of performance art, you know, cover the bases. So I did a little three-act performance. I started off by being a kind of naked guru in a chastity belt, which people had to kind of come and worship. And then the second part was a lecture I gave, a sort of facetious lecture, because there were very Marxist intellectuals in our college, so I was taking the piss out of them. So I did a whole lecture about the fact that art was an anagram of the word rat. And then the third part, though, which is the part I wanted to talk about, I ran an election in college, but I had put up a little ballot box in college a few weeks before, to elect the best artist in the college, democratically. And, of course, this was a very facetious act. And the audience, of course, acted very facetiously in response and elected me as the best artist because they knew I was organising it. And I won the prize, which was a big head that I made. But I learned two things from doing that performance. One was I had to have very low expectation of audience participation. And the other one was that judging quality is a very tricky area. And my lecturer afterwards, he said to me, he said, "That was fun," he said, "but I don't know if it was good art." Because quality then, you know, I realised there was this sort of tension between the idea of popularity and quality within the art world. And they seemed often to be almost at odds with each other. I mean, the fifth most popular art exhibition in the world last year was the David Hockney Show at the Royal Academy, the bigger picture with those big, joyful landscape paintings. And it was paying. Soon after, I was having a conversation with, I shall remain nameless, gallery director of a major contemporary art gallery in this country. And she said she thought it was one of the worst shows she'd ever seen. And I don't think she was alone. A free gallery, might I add, she had. And I don't think she was alone in thinking that, you know, such a popular exhibition wasn't to the taste of someone whose perhaps job was to advance the taste in art of people in this country. Now, there were two very mischievous and funny Russian artists called Komar and Melamed. And in the 1990s, they took this whole idea of popularity literally, and they commissioned a load of surveys in different countries to find out what sort of art people wanted. And then, when they'd got the results of these surveys, which were done professionally, they painted the paintings in accordance with the results. And it was quite shocking. Nearly every country, all it really wanted was a landscape with a few figures or animals in the foreground, mainly blue. And every country wanted this. It's quite depressing. You know, you thought they got any choice they want. They all wanted the same thing. And they said, "In looking for freedom, we found slavery." A visitor to an exhibition, say, like the Hockney exhibition, if they were judging the quality of the art, they might use a word like beauty. Now, if you use that kind of word in the art world, be very careful. There'll be sucking of teeth and mournful shaking of heads. Because their hero, artist Marcel Duchamp, he said this, of urinal fame. He said, "Aesthetic delectation is the danger to be avoided," he said. And so in the art world, sometimes it can feel like to judge something on its beauty, on its aesthetic merits, can almost feel like you're buying into some politically incorrect, into sexism, into racism, colonialism, you know, class privilege. It almost feels it's loaded, this idea of beauty, because it's a construct. Because where does our idea of beauty come from? I mean, Proust says something to the effect that we only see beauty when we're looking through an ornate gold frame. Because beauty is very much about familiarity, and it's a reinforcing an idea we have already. It's a constructed thing built up on shifting layers. It's like when we go on holiday, all we really want to do is take the photograph that we've seen in the brochure. You know, you want to be on Machu Picchu on your own. Because our idea of beauty is constructed, you know, by our family, friends, education, nationality, race, religion, politics. All these things make our idea of beauty. So somebody who chooses curtains, I'm sure they just think, "Oh, I like those curtains, they're nice," you know. But when you think about, what art do you like? My God, you know, it's a nightmare. The self-consciousness is in the very DNA of modernism. I mean, modernism, really, the whole of modernism, the last 100 years of art leading up to, say, 1970s, it was all about the fact that it was self-conscious about the idea it was making art. And so self-consciousness is crippling for an artist. As a schoolboy, I liked Victorian narrative painting. And I've had to go through all sorts of contortions to justify my liking of this. I mean, I like paintings by people like William Powell Frith and George Elgar Hicks. And these are very sort of, why do I like them? They're very English, lovely craftsmanship, social history, good frocks. And I went through all kind of the twists and turns to justify my liking of these. And early on, I was an early readopter. Then I was sort of, I was saying, "Oh, they're modern in their own time, and they're ironic, and they're kind of almost seeming exotic now." And then I'd say, "Oh, they're unashamedly popular. And then all of a sudden, they were becoming popular again. They were becoming fashionable again. They're going, oh no, I've no longer got kooky taste. It will just look like I'm jumping on the bandwagon of liking Victorian narrative painting. So you can see how difficult it is. The role of the artist, and my job day in, day out, is to make sort of aesthetic judgments around such things. And it's the discomfort around it is that it's a soft problem, a subjective problem, you know. So it's very tricky. I'm very sceptical of the idea that you can find a kind of empirical way of judging quality, particularly in art. I mean, we've had attempts of it over history. I mean, the Greeks, they had their golden ratio. William Hogarth, the painter, he had his